Welcome to Classical Companion. I'm Diane Jones, and over the next weeks and months, I'll be chatting with artists and musicians throughout the region about the music they turn to in these challenging times. Today, I'm talking to Sean O'Loughlin with Symphoria. He is the principal pops conductor, and I'm so glad that you could take some time and chat with us. Welcome, Sean.
Well, thank you, Diane. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be on the airwaves and actually, you know, keeping the music alive as any way we can right now. It's taking many different shapes and sizes, so I'm happy that you're doing this series and happy to connect with our audience.
Well, and that's a perfect opening. One of the things I am asking everyone is, how are you doing? How are you and the musicians that you work with dealing with all of this?
You know, we're hanging in as best we can, and I know that's pretty much a stock answer, but I think as this progresses, we're finding different ways with which to engage with each other and with audiences. You know, for me, I've actually done a few Zoom kind of interviews through my publisher, Excelsior Music, so I've connected with some music teachers and their band students, and, you know, we're all just trying to figure out how to do this and keep our lives moving in a positive way. You know, there's challenges too, just on a day-to-day thing, because my wife's not working at home, obviously, and we have two young daughters, 10 and 7, so we're trying to be, you know, one foot in school teacher, one foot in principal, one foot in guidance counselor, and then one foot as a parent, and, you know, we almost feel like an octopus at times, trying to get all these different hands moving at the same time, so, you know, we're doing as best we can. Obviously, we're disappointed with everything that's happening, and, you know, we're being silenced in the live performance area, but it just forces us to be a little bit more creative. And for me, I've actually I've taken to writing too, which is, you know, one of the things I'm blessed to be able to do. And I'm actually programming for next year as well, so I've been writing a little bit and programming for next season's performances, and you know, the beat keeps going, and we're gonna just keep beating that drum as loud as we can and try to connect with audiences as different ways as we can as well.
And one of the ways we connect is through music. What do you look for in music to carry you through times like these?
Well, you know, music can be like a scent, right? Whenever you hear something, it kind of transports you back to a place and time that maybe you first heard it, or a place where it's brought out some, you know, joyous memories. And one of the first pieces of music that I kind of got listening to is Princess Leia's theme from Star Wars, or the original Star Wars soundtrack by John Williams. And I remember, because I went to Solvay High School, and I remember John Spillett was my band director at the time, and he had I'm going to date myself here, Diane, but he had a vinyl copy of the Star Wars soundtrack, and he let me borrow it, and I transferred it onto a cassette tape so I could listen to it on my Sony Walkman. And so in high school, I just listened to that soundtrack over and over, and it was probably the seeds of what got me into writing and got me into this part of my career, is being inspired by John's music and you know, seeing how it fit into the film. And Princess Leia's theme was just incredibly, and still is, an incredibly hauntingly beautiful piece of music. And it always transports me back when I hear it. I feel like I'm 17 again in high school, kind of listening to this music, and as it permeates through my brain, and it kind of, you know, brings me back to a real kind of cool time where the seeds of my career were being planted. And you know, when you listen to it, you'll just hear that it's almost too good to be in a film. You know, it stands on its own, and as much of John's music does. And so that's kind of what I look for, is like a hauntingly beautiful piece of music to just kind of transport you to a different place and time. And that's one of my favorites along the way.
Well, if you want to be nostalgic, Sean, I have that vinyl CD of the original, or the vinyl of the original soundtrack, and I can mail that to you so you can relive those glory days.
That'd be lovely, yes.
Well, every single piece, you've sent me this marvelous list of some of your favorites for us to chat about, and you say every piece of music on this list connects with you in a personal way. Let's just go down the list. You started out by talking about Bernstein and his Symphony No. 2, The Age of Anxiety. Tell us what it is that draws you to that.
So when I was in college at Syracuse University, I was transitioning, well, I was kind of supplementing my music ed degree with a lot of composition lessons, composition programs and courses, et cetera. And I discovered the music of Leonard Bernstein in this process. And it started actually with Leonard Bernstein's passing. So I was a freshman in music theory class. And I remember our professor came in and was just extremely down. And it was the day that Bernstein passed. And so it kind of planted that seed of like, well, let me just, you know, because we all know West Side Story. We all know, you know, his wonderful theater works, et cetera. But like he was a very accomplished, serious composer. And I know he vacillated between being in theater, movies, and the concert hall. And he moved beautifully through that process. And of course, his conducting is legendary as well. And so I stumbled upon this, his Symphony No. 2, which has a solo piano part. And to me, it's almost like an autobiographical piece of music for his career and his life, because it's piano, which he was, of course, a wonderful concert pianist. He conducts these, you know, conducts the piece, and then he's a composer. So it had the bit, you know, three big elements of his career were all wrapped up into this wonderful piece of music. It's in six movements separated into two parts. And it, you can hear the theater influence of it. You can hear the, you know, the gripping kind of powerful movie kind of theatrical thing, and also his serious composing as well. His first symphony, Jeremiah, won an award in New York. I forget exactly what the award was, but it kind of gave him this momentum to keep writing serious works. And there's one movement in the second part of it, I think it's the movement five, where it's literally beautiful kind of percussion and piano piece that's in this crazy time for it. And I wish I could play it, but I can't. I'm not that good a pianist to play that. But it's got this wonderful like three on top of four feel. So you think you're hearing it in three, four times, but when you look at the score, it's actually in four, four, like going across the measures. And so like this fluidity of his writing is really something that's stuck with me in my own writing. And The Age of Anxiety is a poem by W.H. Auden, and Bernstein kind of used that text as a guide of the programmatic nature of the work. So it kind of takes you on a journey as a listener when you listen to this piece of music. And it's just one of those happy places for me when I listen to that music.
Well, let's take a little of that journey together. Well, that was The Age of Anxiety by Leonard Bernstein, with Bernstein not only composing, but conducting. Because, Sean, you've also given me particular recordings that you wanted to listen to, including this next one from Mahler. Talk to us about this Mahler piece, the Symphony 6.
Yeah, Bernstein was one of a select few conductors that actually have conducted the whole Mahler and recorded the whole Mahler symphony cycle, including the unfinished 10th symphony, at least one of the movements from the 10th symphony that Mahler passed away before he was able to finish. And for me, the Symphony No. 6, in particular the first movement, when you listen to it, you can hear where Danny Elfman got his idea for the Batman theme back in 1989. And, you know, a lot of the film composers get their inspiration from great classical works, of course. John Williams, no stranger to that, where the planets was, you know, temp music for Star Wars, and so you listen to the planets and listen to John's Star Wars music, and it's very obvious the connection that is happening there. But for Mahler 6, for me, that first movement has this, you know, incredible chunk, 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 dun, 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 bum, bum, ba, dun, dun. It has this wonderful, like, driving force, and it's his tragic symphony, and so there's a lot of kind of gripping drama, gripping powerful, the slow movement, the adagio is absolutely stunningly beautiful and kind of harkens back to his childhood. There's some kind of like wooden chimes that get played in it that bring you back to his childhood and all. My personal connection with that piece is I used to play it when I would pull all-nighters in college to do papers, and I would listen to Mahler's Symphony No. 6 on a loop almost. And, of course, I had it on my Sony Walkman, mm-hmm. So my parents, because I lived at home for a couple years during college, and since I grew up in Syracuse and I went to the university, so to not keep my mom and dad up and my sisters awake, I would listen to this on the headphones and, typing away on my typewriter. My God, I didn't even have a computer back then. had to write papers on typewriter with whiteout. And then I would wake up, my parents would wake up in the morning getting ready to go to work. And there I'd be, smiling face, with a with a 2-liter bottle of Mountain Dew and, stale coffee, just waiting to put the finishing touches on my latest paper masterpiece. So, but Mahler 6, it's actually very inspiring. There's these wonderful, big moments. In fact, there's the percussionists love it because it calls for like this hammer, and literally like a big sledgehammer that you put, that you slam into a piece of plywood on the stage. And so there's been all sorts of different interpretations. If you go online, different YouTube clips, you can see the different interpretations that percussionists have for this big kind of dramatic moment where they slam this hammer into the plywood on the stage. So it's pretty amazing. And, to see Bernstein both conduct it and hear Bernstein conduct it, you can see the liberties that he takes with the tempi throughout. Some of them are a little bit quicker because he feels it needs that anxiety. And then at times it's brought back even more. And one thing that I always notice about Bernstein, and I've tried to incorporate in my own conducting, is just when you feel like the big moment or arrival or climactic moment of the piece is going to land, he would always delay it by like a split second. And it would generate this kind of unspoken anticipation in the listener. And then when the release came at that moment, oh, it's just like the heavens opened up. And especially with the moment where you have the big sledgehammer into the stage, it's just a wonderful moment. And when you listen to this recording, you'll see just when you feel like it's going to come, it's delayed just a split second, and then it has just an even more magical arrival than what's even written in the original music. So enjoy that part of it.
Well, and you don't have to pull an all-nighter to hear it either. This is
No, it is long, but you don't have to pull an all-nighter.
The Symphony No. 6 of Mahler with Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic. One of the things that I'm getting a kick out of with these conversations is, as all of you are sending me your lists, I'm starting to see some commonalities. And the Rite of Spring actually showed up on Lawrence Lowe's list as well.
Aha!
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. What is it that draws you to the Rite of Spring?
So the Rite of Spring for me as a composer is like the Bible. I call it the Bible, and I mean that in terms of Stravinsky was so creative in his orchestration and his realization of his musical ideas that if I have the score at home, and so if I ever get stuck, if I'm orchestrating a piece of music or arranging or something or one of my original works, and I just want some inspiration for what to do differently or how to think of a phrase or think of a piece of music differently, I always open the Rite of Spring because with each page turn and with each listen, it seems to reveal something else. It's almost like an onion. You know, there's so many layers to that piece of music. And it's hard to imagine that it was originally written for dance, right? It's a ballet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been performed so often as a concert work that the lines are blurred between ballet and concert work. And even, the movie Fantasia, Walt Disney earmarked it for inclusion in that wonderful film, and in the visuals that go with that, with the dinosaurs and kind of this apocalyptic scene, is really, an even different way to look at that piece of music. And it, of course, there's a legendary, story of a riot breaking out because it was so harrowingly different from anything that has been heard in its premiere. I think it's true. We're not, nobody was really there to confirm or not, but or at least the extent of the riot that happened. But again, for me, that music is a way to really kind of spur some ideas compositionally in my head when I get stuck, or to just discover something new that I might not have thought about. I look at that score and, the different effects that he does. It's just incredible.
Well, here is some of the amazing orchestration of Igor Stravinsky with his Rite of Spring. Another work that you and Larry had in common is Romeo and Juliet.
Tchaikovsky.
Tchaikovsky, yes. What draws you to this one?
So this one was really unique. And, the love theme in the middle is very, very famous and has been, performed and extracted from that suite on its own, and it has a life of its own, I feel. And especially in cartoon, I think Bugs Bunny used it a few times, it's a big love theme or whatever it may be. But for me, when I was a senior at Syracuse University, I was in the orchestra and we were playing that. And Alfred Duckett was the director of the orchestra at the university at the time. And I remember he wanted to hear the work in the hall. We were at Krauss College and he wanted to hear the work in the hall. And so he asked me, and I had gotten worked closely with him, and we did a lot of score study, and he gave me some guidance along those lines. And he said, Sean, do you mind conducting this while I go out in the hall to listen? So it was really the first time I ever conducted an orchestra on my own was Romeo and Juliet. And I remember just feeling this incredible burst of energy inside me when I got up on the podium in front of an orchestra like that. And again, it was a little bit of a plant the seed moment. I didn't study, I don't mean to, burst the veil or burst the bubble of anyone who goes to our concerts, but I never really properly got a conducting degree. I had a composition degree and the conducting came out of it, but I've had a lot of conducting experience. And so this was kind of the start of that conducting experience for me, was beautiful Romeo and Juliet. And The one moment that really kind of drew me to this music was that when it first gets fast, and it just, you peel back the layers of that piece of music too, and there's so much happening that creates this kind of wall of sound throughout there. And then of course the storytelling of Tchaikovsky and the story of Romeo and Juliet is just incredible. So for me, it was that seed of like, this conducting thing, let me check this out. This could be a good, viable option for me down the road. And And sure enough, about 20 years later, here I am as a, making a living as a professional conductor. So it's very fond memories of that one as well.
Let's take a listen to the thing that planted the seed for Sean O'Loughlin, the Romeo and Juliet overture from Tchaikovsky. Part of what brings us through when we're listening to music is those memories that it brings up, how the music speaks to us individually as well as universally, don't you think?
Oh, for sure. It's a transportational type of thing for me. And I likened it to smell earlier. It's one of those things our brain just latches onto and really clings to, and music stays with us. And I mean, how many times, even if you're not a professional musician, but how many times have you just had a song stuck in your head, right? Mm-hmm. My 7-year-old is playing a piano exercise called Aardvark Boogie.
Oh,
and
no.
I was up the other night at like 5 a.m, and I couldn't get Aardvark Boogie out of my, I won't play it for you now because then it'll be in your head too. But that's one of the really powerful things about music that that really sticks with us, is the fact that it's so memorable. And even the simplest of themes can be memorable.
Well, you have another Tchaikovsky work on your list here, the Symphony No. 5, in particular, the finale of that movement, or
yeah.
The finale of that piece. Oh, he laughs. Why do you laugh, Sean?
Well, we all have these, kind of, when you're in music school, you obviously you're surrounded by other musicians that are in, similar spots. And I gravitated towards a friend of mine, another composer friend, when I was in graduate school at New England Conservatory. And he happened to live in Boston. And so we would hang out at his house, and he had this amazing sound system. And he was a huge Mozart fan. And then he introduced me to, I just hadn't gotten to Tchaik 5 yet. So I remember being in his apartment one night, and we were just listening to music, just kind of talking about everything, our favorite this. And he said to me, this is my favorite finale of any symphony. And we played this, Tchaik 5. And onward it goes. And that always just kind of stuck with me, of like just having those moments where you can literally nerd out and be a music geek and listen to music and just talk with other musicians about it and really just dive into it. And then fast forward like a year or two after that, when I first moved to Los Angeles, I literally drove across the country with $3,000 and an 86 Honda Accord and figured I would figure it out when I got here. And on the last stretch, as I was kind of pulling onto the 10 freeway, because I had an apartment lined up, so I was on my way, like the final approach to my apartment, I literally, again, in my 1986 Honda Accord, I had it cranked with all my CDs were in the driver or the passenger side. I had Tchaik 5 on, Finale Movement, as I was driving into Los Angeles for the first time to be, to live here and start my career here. So it has a little bit of insurgence of energy for me when I hear that piece of music, and I just kind of close the doors, put my headphones on, play that Finale Movement, and just the pieces. So enjoy.
It's that opportunity for a new beginning, Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5. Here's the finale. Thank you. You talked a little bit earlier about Princess Leia's theme, and now we've come to that on your list.
Yeah, and maybe I could tell a quick John Williams story out of that. So one of, you know, as the final notes of the Fifth Symphony of Tchaikovsky are resonating in the air in L.A., I found myself in a position of opportunity to work for a company that did music preparation and part creation for film scores and TV scores. And John Williams was one of their big clients, probably the biggest client. And so I got to work behind the scenes, not directly with John, but kind of indirectly, where he would, you know, put in his wonderful music and his scores, and then we would create violin parts, harp parts, you know, all the different parts for the orchestra to play at the recording session. And so I did that for about 10 to 12 years of my first years here in Los Angeles. And I got to work on a bunch of really great movies, from some Indiana Jones movies to Star Wars to Harry Potter's. And but one film in particular that I worked on a little bit closer than most was Memoirs of a Geisha, the wonderful adaptation by Rob Marshall, director, and John scored it. And I remember it was one of the last days of the recording sessions, and Yo-Yo Ma was featured cello soloist on it. And at some point they had Itzhak Perlman there as well. But I got to go, John had written like a little kind of bump or a little kind of piece of music that he wanted to record on a session that morning. So the messenger dropped off the music to us at 7, and we all worked on it, jumped on it, kind of copied all the parts, made it, you know, ready for the recording session, which was at 10 a.m. And so the guy who ran our office said, "Hey, Sean, I know you're a big, you know, do you want to bring this music over and just plan on staying at the session?" And so there I am. I bring the music over, and there's John Williams, and it was at Royce Hall in UCLA, is where they were recording it. John loves the acoustics there. When he can't get into to the Sony studios, he goes to UCLA to do that. And they had a big screen, kind of a temporary stage set up. And there I am about 10 feet away from John Williams and Yo-Yo Ma and LA's finest, you know, first call musicians. And they played this one sequence at the end of the film. And it just chokes me up every day to think that I was in that position to see these great artists working and to see John's music kind of come to life. And that piece of music really, from that movie, you can hear the similarities that it had with Princess Leia's theme. So that's why that story kind of sticks in my head as well, is you hear like the passion and the haunting quality that John is able to create. Yes, he writes all these big, you know, heroic themes, but I think one of the real treasures of John's abilities is his deft touch at knowing how to tug your heartstrings in the right way. And Princess Leia's theme, just so beautifully crafted to capture, you know, the heroic nature of Princess Leia, but then also the vulnerable moments that comes with her character and the peril that she's in throughout, and then ultimately becoming a hero again by the end. That's what I like about it.
Let's take a listen to Princess Leia's theme from the original Star Wars soundtrack. This is the thing about film music. It transports you, you know, when you've seen the film, especially a film like this that so many people know. I think the bulk of the public knows it. It transports you as soon as you hear that music.
It's like you're in the theater again. And for me, I was 5 when it came out, when the original movie came out. So it kind of brings me back to my 5-year-old self with my little medium-sized popcorn and, you know, and Coca-Cola and watching the movie, just like, you know, big wide eyes. And I had a chance to take my daughters to the latest movie, Rise of Skywalker, and I felt that same way again. I felt like I was, you know, 2 years old or 5 years old again. And we were cheering when the good guys were winning. We were booing when the bad guys were winning. And it was, you know, it's just, it's entertainment at its purest form. And, you know, to see a movie like that through child's eyes, it's just a really cool, really cool thing.
We have one more work on your list, and this has appeared on a couple of lists as well. And it's kind of no surprise, but it is, it's one of the few pieces, I'll be honest with you, Sean, this is one of the few pieces that has moved me to tears in the past. Mm. Tell us about this final piece on your list.
It's Samuel Barber's wonderful Adagio for Strings. And, you know, the title of it doesn't indicate anything more than a tempo. And it's one of Barber's most just hauntingly gorgeous pieces of music. And it was originally written for string quartet. And then I forget exactly the story, but he was urged to score it for strings because it was part of a string quartet that he wrote. And so he scored it for strings. And the recording that I suggested was the LA Philharmonic with, of course, Leonard Bernstein conducting. And you'll really hear, because, you know, when you have a tempo of music that is so slow, there's just multitudes of opportunities for interpretation. And there's a moment towards the two-thirds of the way, and it also follows the golden rule, right, of like the golden rule in terms of architecture, in terms of, you know, all throughout life, but it's also in terms of music as well, where the climactic moment is about two-thirds of the way through this piece of music. So there's a natural arch form that takes shape. And when they get to that big, big note, the high note at that big climactic moment, Bernstein's recordings, going back to my earlier comment, they tend to hold those moments just a touch longer than you would anticipate as a listener listening to it. And it's just incredible to go on that journey and listen to that piece of music. And, you know, it's at times very solemn. In fact, it was used in, we talk about movie music, it was used in several films. It was a war film that they used. It's just, you know, that imagery that you can put with this piece of music. And again, the title only says a tempo, adagio. It doesn't say, you know, passionate or any kind of descriptor. So Barber allows you as the listener to go on your own personal journey with this music. And again, with the tempo being as slow as it is, you can interpret it as a performer, as a listener. It can really go any way that you want to morph it to kind of fit your mood and fit what you're feeling at the time. And for me, I actually went and got the score for this because I wanted to see, how did he do that? You know, how is this written out? How does this piece of music that exists in the sonic world, how does it look like? And how can I learn from that as a composer and as a conductor? How to, you know, making that connection between what's in sound and what's on the page. And to me, that's where, you know, the craft that Barber uses in this, the inner lines and what you think you're hearing as a melody is sometimes just a counter melody to what's happening elsewhere in the strings and the just the quality of the strings and the writing is really what gravitates me towards it. And it's just a beautiful piece of music.
Let's take a listen to Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. The Los Angeles Philharmonic is led by Leonard Bernstein. that is, as I said, one of the few pieces that has just brought me to absolute tears. And I appreciate you sharing that with us, Sean, and sharing this music that is so personal to you and so important to you in these times.
Yeah, these are my Mount Rushmore pieces.
Is there anything you'd like to leave with us, any thoughts you'd like to leave with us as to being united by music and what music can do for us in these times?
You know, music is the ultimate communicator and the ultimate connector for all of us. And I know we all have challenges on the personal side, and, you know, we're getting a bit stir crazy with all the shelter and at home and place and all that. But I really feel like music can be a connector for us and can bring us peace in a time of unrest. And, you know, we at Symphoria are dedicated to continuing the music to stay alive during these times. And we're investigating all sorts of ways to keep, you know, bringing the beautiful performers of Symphoria into your home in some way, shape, or form. It's going to be digitally for now. But that's okay. You know, that's just the terms that we're given, and we'll do everything we can to provide that that sense of solace and peace and maybe a touch of calm in the storm. And the more we open those lines of communication, the more I think will help us get through this and be stronger on the other side. So I look forward to a day when we can perform again live for everyone. And in the interim, I'll give everyone a social distance warm hug and just hope we get this and to you too, Diane. So feel the hug, feel the love, so.
Feel the love. Well, yes. Once again, Sean O'Loughlin with Symphoria, the principal pops conductor with Symphoria, thank you so much for taking some time and chatting with us and sharing this music that speaks so much to you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, and be safe, everyone.